You are now listening to The Home Run with Helmut and Dwight, weekdays from 4:30 to 6, only on Eagle FM. Download the app or tune in to a frequency near you. Tune in to The Home Run with Helmut and Dwight on your number one talk radio station, Eagle FM, and be part of an in-depth discussion on events you didn't know you needed to hear until you do. From Namibia, Africa, and around the world, tune in from Monday to Friday from 4:30 to 6 p.m. only on Eagle FM. So we start off on this particular Wednesday, obviously with a little bit of a... We have to be concerned specifically about the next particular realm, the next particular development, next particular level, at which the most probably the international relations realm will possibly descend into another particular conflict dimension. I say this strictly because, yes, we've obviously seen for the past 3 months since 28 February the particular Iran conflict taking shape, which has now basically become the Hormuz conflict, or the conflict for the Strait of Hormuz, whichever label you wish to apply and whichever particular indication you wish to take, a discussion on international relations and whichever particular scenario. But before me actually greeting you guys, just to let you know, is that if you've seen our post on today's social media, that's the Eagle FM social media platforms, obviously, the discussion is based upon Cuba, but it's based upon the particular dimension of what the AU in their decisions, declarations, and resolutions document of February earlier this year had highlighted. That's when the heads of state, the African heads of state, obviously who are AU members, were there. They basically issued this particular assembly resolution at the end. The resolution on the lifting of the economic, commercial, and financial blockade imposed on Cuba by the United States of America. I just needed to highlight that particular talking point to you because currently what's happening here is, as I was not hoping, what the United States would do. Primarily pick fights with countries in the region of the Americas, and specifically with those deemed as, and I have to put this in quotation marks, as enemies of the United States, because enemies in 2026 is also a vague term to even use, because back then, and I'm talking about back in the Cold War era, even up to the 1990s, a scenario of enemies was actual invasion, was literal threat of invasion by a neighboring country next to you. Today, there's really no reason. There's really no reason. Globalization, advanced commercialization activities, aspects of, you know, having better relations with neighbors as nations, with each other, have actually provided more benefits to many nations and their populations around the world. Specifically, just look at the vast benefits that all the European countries are enjoying from each other from being together in the EU. They all derive major benefits. They all derive major opportunities specifically for their nationals, their populations, and they also derive further benefits from each other, benefits they could not unlock from each other, that they could in some cases not access, probably because the industry was not there, or they didn't have the skills, or they didn't have the manpower, or they didn't have the investment space primarily to try and pursue those particular kinds of developments. Now, I'm describing to you here in the start of this discussion a lofty disposition of where the whole world wants to be. I'll be honest with you guys. In actual fact, I am sick and tired of wars. In actual fact, I'll tell you this. I'm sick and tired of wars. So I already have a predisposition. I don't like wars. Since 1990, you know, when I started actually being able to to understand information from news sources, from TV programs, from adult conversations. I have been exposed, and there's not a 10-year period there where my life had not included a conflict. In my life, had not included a conflict. And it's a very interesting fact to observe. In the 1990s, you don't hear this much about many Namibians, but not many Namibians talk about this particular conflict, the conflict that Namibia participated in, the conflict that was identified as Africa's own world war. There were more countries participating in that conflict than there were in the Second World War. Did you guys know this? No, you didn't. Another dimension, obviously, was the dimension of the 1994 Rwanda genocide, which was also an eye-opener for me. I was 11, 10? Yeah, I was 10 that year. Another dimension then flowed into what I heard as snippets and snapshots from the Balkan War, which was the former Yugoslavia. That's the whole 90s, all three conflicts in one scenario. I had heard snippets of the Somalia War at the start of that decade, and as well as also the impact of the first Gulf War when Kuwait asked the US to please show up and beat up Iraq. So I heard all those particular things. Yes, I remember all those conflicts by time frame, who their presidents most probably were in many scenarios, and, you know, what it technically speaks towards the realm of international relations. Now, if you look at what I just explained to you, and you cascade from the 90s into the 2000s, we started with the horrific events, obviously, of what happened to the World Trade Center in New York with the famous three passenger airplanes crashing into the World Trade Center Twin Towers in New York. Devastating event, definitely. But what emanated from that particular event? So, the whole roadshow. Yes, it was a roadshow. And I'm sorry for the PROs who work in ministries and in SOEs here in Namibia who love using the word roadshow. We have this roadshow to communicate to the country. But George W. Bush, Tony Blair, and some of the other particular proponents from the American side of things went on a roadshow. And I remember that roadshow as clear as in 8K. It's no longer even HD. It's now HK. It's now 8K resolution. I remember it as clear as yesterday. The supposed weapons of mass destruction for Iraq. Firstly, it was getting into Afghanistan. That happened. No one cared. At that stage, people didn't even know Afghanistan existed. Even Leon Schuster, the famous South African satirical filmmaker, produced his own, you know, sort of like movie based upon the satire of, you know, the global war and terror. And then obviously Iraq in 2002, mid-2001, leading into 2003, Iraq happened. So we got another 10 years of war. But both those periods of 10 years of war, technically for the Afghanistan scenario, the Afghanistan chapter led into a 20-year war, which the Americans didn't budget for. 2011 comes by, and we have, firstly, the Arab Spring, and then secondly, the 1-2 strike that happened in Libya, under the guise of the Arab Spring. Towards the end, basically, of that decade of the 20-teens, we get the discussion, obviously, that then rolled in terms of when you look at conflicts, the civil war in in Ethiopia, the now, in 2024, the conflict that popped up, the civil war conflict that popped up it's 2023, I think. 2023, the conflict that popped up in Sudan, and then obviously also the conflict from Gaza that now has become this hotbed of conflicts. And now it's just conflicts all around. But we find ourselves fast forwarding to 2026, with 3 January being the most significant of the bookmarks, if you're thinking in terms of like a, you know, pinning a message like in WhatsApp or a bookmark that you put in your book just to say, this is where I stopped off. This is, I've read up until here. Now, bookmarking is more significant than pinning a message, because pinning a message is just like putting a message on a notice board. Anyone can do that. But when you bookmark something, it is an exact point to rejog your memory. So I went more with the bookmark. Bookmarking a thing needs to tell you, yes, you, the listener out there, that we're not done. Oh, we are not done. Oh, we are far from done. Now, this afternoon's discussion, and firstly, informally, welcoming you once again, dear listeners, to a home run session specifically, where we have to step into the international relations realm, because things are as murky as the water that City of Windhoek had 2 weeks back, when many of you were also wondering about the quality of said particular water at some times. But it's even murkier than that, so... Don't worry, City of Windhoek is still trying to maintain standards, whereas the realm of international relations in the proverbial or illustrative waters that international relations now finds itself in is superbly filthy. It's dirty, it's toxic, it is polluted, because no one can make use of it. Everybody else is now talking to everybody else because no one wants to come close to the United States. Which probably also has to tell you that the famous words that Donald Trump used last year, specifically where he said, with a tariff, you know, with the tariff announcements, Liberation Day, do you guys remember that? Or Liberty Day? It's Liberation Day or Liberty Day, one of the two. Where he went and said, yeah, all countries want to talk to him. Well, it definitely does seem that no one wants to talk to the Americans. No one wants to talk to them. So we position the following hypothesis. Helmut just has to join us a little bit later. Don't worry, guys. But this is the following hypothesis that we sit with. How many wars do you think will be started just in this year alone from the Americans, by the Americans? My safe bet is technically, probably 4. I just don't know who the fourth one is. I opened up the, you know, in preparation for today's show, I opened up the national security strategy that they authored and launched back in September last year. And in preparation for the show primarily, which is about the fate of Cuba, which the United States now, they are starting to make sounds in that discussion since the start of this year. Is really alarming, because you and I know Namibia does have very good relations with Cuba, even though as strained as it is because of the sanctions that Cuba and the blockade that Cuba has been facing since the Cuban Missile Crisis. For some reason, the Americans still believe that, since Che Guevara and Fidel Castro decided to, you know, start their own thing and basically divorce Cuban socioeconomic ties from American agricultural industrialist ties. Yes. That is where it all began. That is actually where it starts from. That is actually the history and the relationship of Cuba and the United States, was because the largest landowners in Cuba during, just before the Cuban Revolution took place, were American farmers, American sugar and tobacco farmers, or you can call them farmers, but in many cases they were technically industrialists, you know, agricultural industrialists. Now, I don't know if you're trying to look at, for example, like in terms of a resemblance of a situation specifically like here in Namibia, where in the land bill, Namibia is trying, or the parliamentarians, should I rather say, they are trying to ban foreign land ownership specifically of agricultural land in Namibia, which is a good thing, mind you. It is a very good thing. But it does come with its own caveats, Because if you're seeking investment from foreigners and you are telling them, but you can't own the land, but foreigners can own a mining company that owns the mining complex, then what level of contradiction are you actually running around with? Which is once again some of the particular talking points that I always highlight to you here, or that we highlight to you guys here on ELFM specifically, is what are we trying to achieve? But we're not talking about Namibia today. It's not about Namibia and Namibia's policy directions and policy awareness elements. We're not talking about that. We're talking about the fate of one of Namibia's closest, countries that Namibia has had the closest bilateral relations with. Now, I'll say this categorically today because this is a fact. Namibia has had more and better and longer bilateral relations with Cuba than with the United States. I'll say it again. Namibia has had longer relations with Cuba than with the US. But as I said, this is not a discussion about Namibia. So I won't be answering a question on whether or not what will Namibia do the moment Cuba possibly gets invaded. Which is the rhetoric that the United States is using. Now, I know I sound very serious, guys. That's why I'm always in my bad cop. What they call it, persona. Because the following facts have to be placed in front of you. The wording from this resolution document that the AU heads of state had indicated was worrisome. Because the AU heads of state also pointed towards a source document that started this whole 21st century bilateral relations nightmare, specifically for many countries that form part of the global south. Now, Venezuela is from the global south. Venezuela was invaded briefly, but still somehow Venezuela is compromised by American military action directly in Venezuela. So Venezuela is trying to hide themselves, but also protect themselves because they have to find a direction for themselves to technically rebound from what they experienced at the start of this year. Now, even though the noise that Donald Trump is making and the noise that much of specifically the political landscape in the United States was making regarding who Nicolas Maduro was, in actual fact, I can't be bothered who the man was, because it's Venezuela's national leader. They voted the man in. Dwight did not vote them in. You, as a Namibian, didn't vote the man in. It's their choice in national leader. But the concern has been, we once again saw a high definition. The resolution standards have increased. It's apparently now it's 8K. 8K is the latest standard. There's actually another one competing with 8K, but 8K is apparently the latest standard. Is that we saw in 8K resolution on the internet and across the various news sources how Maduro and Venezuela technically were humiliated by the Americans, because it spells to humiliation. Basically, it literally not spells, shouts, humiliation. The second scenario was that the Americans didn't care what actions they technically took, because they basically went and undermined your constitution as a country. And they also undermined basically all the whole rules about, just beating someone up. Let me rather call it that, because it looked like a beating. Helmut,
sure,
how you doing?
Was.
Yeah, it sure was.
Yeah, all good, how are you?
I'm good, man.
And good afternoon, listeners. And thank you for having the patience. And I'm glad you call it the beating, because that was humiliating.
Yeah. I highlighted just now before you joined us, Helmut, that since 1990 in my personal life, I've observed major conflicts for 30 years in a row. There's not been a 10-year period where there was actual peace in the world. Yeah. No conflicts, no one trying to beat each other up, no one having outstanding debts regarding, yeah, since you came and caused a genocide in my country, I'm going to go and exact revenge. Mm-hmm. I've not seen nor known peace around the world for 10 years. In the 10-year periods, the 1990s up to 2000. To the 2000s up to 2010, the 2010s up to 2020. And now since from 2021 to 2026, we've just had conflicts. And this is not an AU thing even, eh?
No, this is
This is not our running joke of silencing of the guns.
This is just the world over.
Yeah, this is just the world over. Now, here's a funny thing, Helmut, that actually starts this discussion off. So I went back in preparation for today's show. I went back to that document we dissected back in, I think it was November, December, the National Security Strategy from the US, where they spoke about the Western Hemisphere, which is literally North America, Central America, South America, and the Caribbean.
Yeah.
They make no mention of Cuba there. The rhetoric, the language, is all about other nations who are hostile to us, but who are also not mentioned, because now we have to assume who's hostile. Remember, with the tariff discussion from the Americans, the whole world was hostile. Remember? Because we didn't buy enough American products, but America had positioned their economy to be a consumption economy, not to be an exporting economy.
Yeah.
And everybody was happy not to buy American made products because the observation, which is the body language, which is the actions on the ground, was, oh, don't worry, we're happy to just sell to you. So the Americans were happy to just buy.
You know, in 2003, Chris Hedges, he was an American journalist. He was still with the New York Times at the time.
Mm.
He wrote an article where he said the following, where he said that from his observation and expert point of view, as someone that works in the media with the years of experience under his belt, that over 3,400 years of human history that's been recorded in that recorded time period of 3,400 years, human beings has only been at peace for 268%. 268 years of those, which is 8%. 8% out of 3,400. That's for how long we have been at peace. That means when it comes to conflicts, we are very good at, we'll find any excuse to go to war with each other.
Which is exactly.
And it's more often interest-based, so it all boils down to greed.
Well, if you want to use the word greed in the interest definition, then I'll just supplement the other labels that also form part of the interest discussion.
Mm-hmm.
Earlier today, I watched Zoran Mamdani's father. I thought the uncle was no longer on earth here with us, but he had a discussion about one of his books,
mm-hmm.
because he's also a historian. The man explained there, Helmut, how, because he said Museveni was one of his friends while they were both on university, before Museveni became the Museveni that we Africans know today. And the particular book, his latest book's name is Slow Poison. And he was obviously there in London, and he's Ugandan, basically.
Yeah.
The lecturer or the other academic interviewing him for his book, basically, about his book discussion, is Zimbabwean.
In London.
In London.
Seriously?
So Mamdani works at what's that university in the US? What's that university's name, man?
Okay, you're going to love
it. But it's somewhere there in the East Coast. This lady, the lady interviewing him, this doctor, she's in London at a university there. He's co-author on the book, which is a Tanzanian academic.
Yeah.
Also works in London. He also works in London. And yeah, I mean, it was a funny thing to see there because there were also come a bunch of South Africans also in the audience and other Zimbabwean academics who live in London. Mm-hmm. But the whole conversation that Mahmoud and Mamdani highlighted primarily because was, and he's known as one of the foremost academics, Mahmoud, about African political science because the man literally, he knew Idi Amin, he knew Nyerere, he knew, what was the other guy's name? The guy that you mentioned yesterday.
You have Kenyatta.
The Kenyatta and the Odinga guy. He knew of them as well. And he also knew of the role that the Israelis and the British played in the 1960s, specifically in the independence movements. But before that, we've got to take a quick ad break.
Step right up to ShopRite's Big Low Price Carnival, where the deals are big and the savings are even bigger. Get show-stopping deals like 4kg Real Good IQF Chicken Mixed Portions for only $209.99. That's a big deal. And 5kg Polana Elbows or Macaroni Pasta for a low $124.99 each. Valid until 7 June 2026. Don't miss out on these unbelievable savings and more at the Big Low Price Carnival, only at ShopRite. Plus, you could stand to win one of 250 trolley dashes. Simply buy any three or more participating products and stand to win with ShopRite's Big Low Price Carnival. Competition ends 7 June. T's and C's apply.
So coming back, dear listeners, and just the quick break that I made, the quick point I was going to make before the ad break was, so what Mahmoud Mamdani tried to highlight was primarily the precariousness of international relations and specifically in a post-colonial setup specific for there in Central Eastern Africa. So the reason why I'm highlighting the international relations realm in a post-colonial setup, Helmut, was a discussion based upon how us countries from the global south are perceived. Né?
Yeah.
And an interesting thing, because I was also in preparation for today's program, trying to find the one video that I watched. I just don't know if it was an Al Jazeera particular, sort of like an excerpt discussion where they had their own particular production done. But it was about the language being used by the Americans in terms of why are they now putting their folk, trying to move away from Iran,
mm-hmm.
but they know they're not done with Iran. And the whole world is telling them, Sort your business out with Iran.
Yeah.
But in between, they've been talking about Cuba. Yeah. Especially Marco Rubio. Especially Donald Trump. Because Donald Trump, and I'm sitting here with what's this fact? They call it a fact sheet, but it was an extra sanctions that were imposed by Trump early this year. Okay. The fact sheet is dated 1 May last month. And then there was obviously also back in January and February, the announcements obviously regarding the threats that the US, that the perceived threats that Cuba poses to the US. I say perceived threats.
Yeah.
Now, here's where things get interesting, Ahmed. And this is the actual discussion. This is the actual discussion. So, I'm so glad that the AU heads of state highlighted this particular document. This document, they cited in their resolutions, which is actually the last page of the resolutions, decisions, and declarations document. They cited a document by the name of the Helms-Burton Act by the United States, and especially Chapter 3. Now, remember in our description, we mentioned this Chapter 3. Discussion regarding the US-Cuba relations.
Yeah.
And when you go look up that Helms-Burton Act, this is an act from, is it 1996? Its other name is known as formerly the Cuban Liberty and Democratic Solidarity Act of 1996. Now the word democracy has now become something like a, You know when you leave a car in the sand.
Yeah.
Not in the sand, in the sun. When you leave a car in the sun a lot, have you seen what happens to its paint, Helmut? It starts getting that sunburn.
Yeah.
Fading. You're right with the fading sun, the fading color scheme that they experience.
Yeah.
Now this word democratic solidarity discussion that the Americans love throwing in, which obviously has become a running joke on the internet also about the US willing to deliver democracy to you, has become a sort of like a trope. A label that is used loosely, but it doesn't actually define your national identity. I would ask you, Helmut, do you condone, because I don't condone it, but would you condone another country shaping its neighbor in its image? Or would you allow this neighboring country, to just go on its way? And then you try to establish, you know, what the AFCFTA here on the African continent wants us to pursue, neighborly conduct, and improving on that neighborly conduct to take it to the next level of friendliness, trade, positive economic migrationary trends, and everybody's just benefiting from everybody else's efforts. Which one would you prefer?
Now, that, you know, that question is the reason why, Dwight, my favorite branch of law is public international law.
Yeah.
And now, if you can just trace it to, you know, to its founding when Hugo Grotius, the Dutch theologian and scholar. You have to understand that this is a
wasn't
man.
He the guy about the high seas law? The thing that that you and I looked into?
Yeah, he's the one. And you see, that's the man that wrote a book on, on the laws of war and peace.
Yeah.
And that's basically considered like the Bible or the founding document of international law. And now the argument, or more like his point of view on, on different countries and relationships they have, both political and be it political or economically, is that everything must be based on consent.
Mm.
Like, he emphasized heavily on consent. So the whole idea of different countries having treaties is from that very same, document of the rules of peace and rules on peace and war. Now, his idea was that because you have to understand that before that, a lot of rules regulating people and states and the people basically and their property was heavily, based on. Was heavily based on religion.
Mm.
Now, for someone that's coming out of a religious setting himself, he really wanted to draft, rules and regulations that will regulate the relationship between countries. That's based on one thing.
Yeah.
Consent. In other words, if you want a relationship with another country, you're going to have to, follow diplomacy, sit and talk to them. And when you are talking to them, maybe you have to understand that when you ask someone for something, be ready for both yes and no. They're going to either say yes if they like your proposal or no if they don't like your proposal. Except, that's on paper.
And that's the piece of advice now that I share with people every day. Have you ever seen young people when they come and ask you something and you just tell them no, I don't want to do it?
Yeah, and they start throwing a fit.
And then you see the disappointment in the face, and then you school them at the same time by saying, but you forget that I own the right to say no.
Yeah.
I don't have to agree.
When you ask someone for something, that's what it implies. When you ask someone for something, get ready for either yes
or no.
Or no.
Or the person can ignore you. They don't even have to answer.
Yeah, they don't have to answer you.
Yeah.
Yeah. You're right. They don't have to answer you.
Yeah. Or they can completely change your approach.
Mm-hmm.
Nah, and submit something else to you and say, but first you have to do this for me.
Yep.
They can give you a condition to meet.
But, it's like, the selfish part of, of our mentality as a species, that every time that we ask someone for something,
we
already have a yes at the back of our head.
We assume it will be a yes.
Exactly. Yeah. So when we get a no, we have this whole degree of disappointment, and then you start even cursing and insulting them. Well, you were there to ask. You are not there to dictate them.
You can't even dictate.
Yeah. Now, so the reason why I started on with, the reason why I started on with Grotius' point of view on international law and international relations is because of the whole idea that he, you know, at least in theory, he thought international law, international relations should be based on.
Yeah.
It should be based on one thing, that's consent.
Yeah.
The person that you are, or, you know, the country that you are asking, you know, they are going to say yes to you, to your proposal, or they are going to say no to your proposal. You have to get ready for that. But the thing is, in the very same way that as individuals, we are terrible at taking no for an answer, it turns out collectively as countries as well, we're just as terrible, because every time that you ask a country for, you know, for access to its resources, information, whatever it is that you want, like to have access to, and they say no, you start sending in espionage guys, and then you start putting together means and ways to topple that government.
We have seen this taking place
in Venezuela, for example.
Exactly. And there's also a reason why I mentioned Mahmoud Mamdani's particular conversation that he had about his book that I watched earlier today was... He mentioned how specifically no one trusted Idi Amin. No one on the African continent trusted Idi Amin.
No, I think the guys, okay, before he became a president of Uganda, he was a kukmos for the soldiers that were fighting for the crown.
Not just that. That specific discussion between Kuk and before he became leader, he was doing things there, but he was trained by the Israelis. Him and his guys, they were trained.
Why is his son so anti-West, basically?
Oh, no, he was discovered. It's also in that interview. The son was discovered. The son apparently went and told the world that he was an orphan. He doesn't know who his parents were. And then he was, like, outed by...
He doesn't know who his parents were?
No, he did know who his parents were, but he had to build a new identity after the death of his father. And then he was outed by someone else, by literally someone that said, you know, like what happened with, what was that? What was one of the apostles of Jesus? The guy that denounced Jesus three times at three intervals.
Oh, yeah, that was Peter.
When Peter was outed by that woman while he was eating in the town, and he said, hey, listen, aren't you one of Jesus's disciples or like, apostles? And he was like, nah, what are you talking about? That's another guy.
I ain't seen nothing.
Yeah, I don't know who you're talking about. That's a guy that just looks like me. So, on a situation like that, the indication that you can see clearly is that there's always some sort of a superpower behind something. Now, we obviously know in this
That's what I was pointing out when it comes to terrorism yesterday. Yeah. Wherever you see a bunch of guys running around trigger happy,
supposed terrorism.
They're just, you know, they're just deranged bunch of guys that happen to be very organized in their attacks. It doesn't make sense.
Yeah. Exactly that one. It's a funny thing, for example, like, apparently everyone had issues with the French soldiers when they were in Mali. Yeah. But no one has an issue with the Russian mercenaries? Wagner.
The Wagner group running around,
causing havoc and shooting at everyone, because war is havoc. There is no such thing as clean war or war about, oh, look at them, they're beating each other up. Can we sit here and look? Yes, you can. No, war has bullets flying everywhere. Mm-hmm. And sometimes you're the collateral.
Yep.
It hits you and you weren't even aimed at. So discussions like that is the basis specifically of why the world should be nervous of potentially what's going to happen to Cuba. Now, here's the thing. In the fact sheet of 1 May from the White House, I'm reading it right here. They're sitting here directly just announcing it. Imposing sanctions on the Cuban regime. Straightforward. That was the latest development. Now, it states here that the order broadens the existing sanctions on Cuba to include new restrictions under the International Emergency Economic Powers Act, which is basically the powers that gives the U.S. president, any U.S. president, the ability to sanction any other country, which doesn't conform to any international law. Let me state that clearly. It doesn't conform to any international relations. That means that technically, you as another country, you don't have to listen to the U.S. president. You don't. But do you think that happens? No, it doesn't. Because everyone is scared to the brim.
Yep.
And they're afraid of you know, I don't know what, but losing out specifically on something from the American economy. A second scenario is obviously the following statement, Hamoud, that I don't know where this comes from. Countering Cuba's malign influence. The U.S. president is addressing the national security threats posed by the communist Cuban regime by taking decisive action to hold the Cuban regime and those that perpetuate it accountable for its support of hostile actors, terrorism, and regional instability that endangers American security and foreign policy. Now, in reality, I have not heard of Cuba financing terror. I have not. I'm sorry, Hamoud.
You know,
I'm lost.
No, Cuba, if they have done that, it's either they haven't done it,
yeah,
or they are very good at it.
But before we continue, we're going to take an ad break.
Yeah.
Step right up to ShopRite's Big Low Price Carnival, where the deals are big and the savings are even bigger. Get show-stopping deals like 6.6-liter platinum digital air fryer for only $999.99. That's a big deal. And 200 grams Nescafe Classic Roast instant coffee for a low $135.99. Valid until 7 June 2026. Don't miss out on these unbelievable savings and more at the Big Low Price Carnival, only at ShopRite. Plus, you could stand to win one of 250 trolley dashes. Simply buy any three or more participating products and stand to win with ShopRite's Big Low Price Carnival. Competition ends 7 June. T's and C's apply.
So we come back, dear listeners, there from the quick break. And you are once again here on The Home Run with your drive time duo. That's me, Dwight, and Helmut in the studio, obviously, as we are dissecting how fragile the international relations realm is becoming and how more supposedly volatile, according to the US, it is, without actually providing any proof. Because this is a document also, once again, devoid of any proof. Like you said, Helmut, it's either the Cubans cannot or they are not doing it, or they've been doing it so well that it's technically
that no one knows about it.
That no one knows about it. I actually like the second one.
Yeah.
That nobody knows about it.
Okay,
because it actually shouts volumes because no one knows about it.
You know why it's you know, it's very difficult to believe that Cuba is a sponsor of terrorism. Mm. If you look at the Cuban economy and what it's been for the past and what's been for the past 60, 70 plus years, that economy has been strangled. It will be very difficult to to explain. This is a country that's been under sanctions, embargoes, blockades of all kinds.
Mm.
Yeah, I mean, it was the Russians sailed. They sailed an oil tanker to Cuba because they have the army to do that.
No. Rephrase that again, Helmut. Remember what I said before the break? Mm-hmm. If you're willing to go against those sanctions, you can do it because you don't have to follow those sanctions. That's technically what the Russians did.
That's what they did. But the thing is, if you were Russia, being one of, if not the most heavily sanctioned country as of now, you don't have anything to worry about.
Why would you care?
You're already being sanctioned. Like, what can they do more? Like, sanction you even more?
Yeah.
But at this point, Europe, when it comes to Russia, have just resorted to one of the most boring solution to any problem I've ever heard of, which comes a lot out of the United Nations, ICC and ICJ, which is, we have written a very strongly worded condemnation letter. Really? We condemn. That's the most useless solution I've ever heard of. You condemn me, but yeah, people are dying.
Mm.
And the best you can do is we condemn. And that's a part of the problem. Part of the problem is you can see that the Chinese, take for example, the Chinese and the Chinese and the French, if they wanted to, and and the Russians, they can do that.
Yeah.
Now, if you look at countries, and the painful thing about international relations, especially today, is that countries that have a large military power only negotiate with countries that also have, you know, that have the enough military power to fight back.
Yeah.
But if you are a country like, you know, like Namibia, there's not much fighting that you can do, especially not in terms of, you know, not in terms of military. There's not much you can do.
Yeah.
And that now, that is, unfortunately, is the condition for a lot of countries on this planet. That's why most of the votes can't do, you know, whether it's being done, you know, on an African Union level or in a, on an UN General Assembly level. It doesn't have much of an effect. Why? It's because most of the countries that are voting against whatever resolutions whatever it's that's being proposed by a larger power, it's either they don't have the military, political, or economic strength to survive the backlash of their decision.
Which is basically North Korea.
And you see, North Korea is demonized because North Korea can now fight back.
Yeah.
And this is the same thing that you know. This is the same thing that seems to emerge, with Cuba, because if the problem with Cuba is, let's just entertain the very blatantly false, I may say, the whole idea that Cuba is a state sponsor of terrorism.
Yeah.
And now let's just go with let's pick the precedents from there. That you know what? Because Cuba is financing terrorism. Let's sanction them. Excellent. Yeah. Now, let's just push that application of international law all the way through.
Yeah.
If you did that, the entire Western world will collapse.
Yep.
It would.
It would.
Yeah, because take, for example, when it comes to... one painful thing about... powerful countries is that they have a tendency of declassifying files 50, 60 years down the line.
Oh, those are lovely.
Yeah. And that's when you start, take for example 1953 when Mohammed Mossadegh was overthrown. Can you imagine being an American and being a British talking about the CIA and MI5 getting involved in overthrowing a nation's leader?
Yeah.
No one would have listened to you. And if you were head by the FBI, the police, or Scotland, your chances are very high you would have been sent to jail.
Yeah.
Yeah.
If you and were
that's
alive.
That's the best case scenario.
Yeah.
Yeah. But, 1953 is a long time ago. Now we are openly talking about, how, the two intelligence communities of two different countries decided to overthrow, an elected leader of a sovereign nation for a private company's interest.
For the same sovereign nations.
Yeah.
Own resource.
Yep. Now we can talk about it.
And if you want to ask discussions about corruption, then you can't look there?
Yeah.
How do you go fight on behalf of your private company's interests in another country?
You are literally causing a lot of havoc in one country to the point where you are literally killing people so that you can secure private interest of a private company. Unfortunately, that template, it worked. It worked on Mohammed Mossadegh. That's why it was. And the second, I think, trial run was on, on Chile with Salvador Allende.
Yeah.
And after it worked from there, then the MI5 and CIA were like, "Hang on a second, why negotiate when you can first just send, send in?" If you look at the Salvador Allende and. Salvador Allende and who is this? Mohammed Mossadegh.
Mm.
Yeah. Is it Suharto or Sukarno in Indonesia?
Sukarno.
Yeah.
No, Suharto.
Suharto.
Yeah.
That's the guy who was overthrown and replaced by by also full blown dictator. And now you see on Suharto, one interesting thing about the whole Suharto discussion is that. It showed just how far the intelligence communities in the, especially the US and the UK, and Europe, are willing to go to discredit a leader.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because they, I mean, they made fabricated, adult videos of the president so they can blackmail him against his people so that they can get angry and protest and overthrow him themselves.
Yeah. Now,
and after kicking him out of power, and it worked. You want to guess, you know, in both Indonesia, in both Indonesia and Iran and Chile.
Mm.
One thing, you know, one thing that you see in all these three examples is that someone who was loved by the people was kicked out of office, and the guy that took over went full dictatorship mode from day one.
Yeah.
And for some reason, all of a sudden, the guys that had had a problem with, you know, with the overthrown guy because of his quote unquote human rights violations didn't have a problem with the guy that was literally making his own people disappear, which is, that's what, you know, Augusto Pinochet was doing in Chile. And that's what, the Shah was doing in Iran.
Mm.
The 1979 overthrow was not because the Shah was very caring to his people.
No, it wasn't.
He was making his own people disappear.
He started most one of the earliest forms of what we know as corruption in the global south.
And he was loved to the point where he was loved by the West to the point where they helped him build his own nuclear enrichment facilities. That's how much they loved him.
And I wonder who approved that. Definitely the CIA.
You bet those guys.
Yeah, definitely. So I'm so glad, Helmut, that you started on that Iran scenario as well, because for the listener, for us outside of the United States, we've known the history of the U.S. and Cuba.
Yeah.
The more prominent, if I can say, chapter would have been the Cuban Missile Crisis, which is actually something that the Soviets orchestrated, not the Cubans, basically. But the Cubans were probably just happy to go like, oh, no, don't worry, bruh. Just
hand them over.
Just bring them, you know. Come and train our guys also how to press a button. Mm-hmm. You know, we would like to also feel that,
Kim Jong was like, you know what, I'll figure it out.
That, that macho feeling of having a big weapon close to you, you know, we'd also like to show it. Now, the Cuban Missile Crisis obviously didn't make anything or didn't ease any tensions, because primarily that whole discussion was between the two leaders.
Yeah.
John F. Kennedy and Khrushchev. The downside was Castro was still kept out of those discussions, even though the missiles were on Castro's island.
Yeah.
Castro's Cuba was still blockaded and sanctioned, even though it was probably Castro's idea.
Most probably.
I'm assuming, but it probably looked like a Castro idea. So that event technically brought the two world superpowers together, but it didn't resolve issues between the U.S. and Castro.
No.
Or U.S. and Cuba. But at the heart of everything, Helmut, now I looked up, because I heard recently that Marco Rubio had to go and explain before a Senate or Congressional Committee. Mm-hmm. I just want to get this committee's name. The Senate Foreign Relations Committee, in terms of the supposed reforms that Cuba needs. And there was obviously a discussion based on it. Now,
the reforms that Cuba needs.
These are all Americans speaking on what must be done to Cuba.
This is the scramble of Africa all over again.
Yeah, but just in a Cuban.
Yeah.
In Cuba, regarding Cuba. You put it for Cuba there. Now, some analysts highlighted specifically, one of the first things to create pressure in Cuba was obviously to remove Maduro, because Maduro kept sending like discounted petroleum to Cuba.
To Cuba, yeah.
Yeah. So the Cuba's whole petrochemicals and refining capabilities and refineries can assist their own national needs.
Yeah.
And, you know, Venezuela was selling it at a discounted price. And the people that were killed in what happened on 3 January were predominantly Cuban advisors, economic and security advisors for Maduro, because the Americans and even Trump went and announced, yeah, they were Cuban terrorists. I don't know how you call Cuban government workers are terrorists. But yeah, apparently they were terrorists, according to the Americans.
Now, let's define terrorists now, shall we? If we define the word terrorist technically...
What do you want? Oxford Dictionary, Cambridge Dictionary, even the South African dictionaries in Afrikaans...
All you just have to do is just pick a dictionary and find the word terrorist. And and then you take that definition and give it to...
And then ask the Americans to define it.
No, not American. Just go to the Middle East and ask them, according to this definition, are American soldiers terrorists or not? And a lot of them will tell you, well, according to their own definition, they would be terrorists. The word terrorist itself is from the word terramos, which literally means to cause fear.
Well, you'll be surprised about the earliest meaning of the word terrific.
Oh, yeah. Oh, no. Terrific. You know, it's like the word apparent has the somewhat too confused. You know,
and awesome. The word awesome.
That's even more sarcastic.
The word awesome, which now means... You know, it looks good.
Yeah,
it superb. Looks wonderful. It's superb. It's, you know, it's basically a description of, oh, wow, I'm impressed.
Yeah.
But the word awesome was supposed to be from the word in awe, which it was, you know,
in awe.
You were in awe of something. You were surprised, but you are like surprised because it's not something you expected. But in awe also of a scenario that it sometimes also is scary. Because in shock and awe is one of those things that which is also the military strategy, shock and awe.
Yeah, just overwhelm.
Basically. Now, when you get to terrific, which is, it sounds terrific, sounds like a wonderful idea in the sentence, but the word terrific was supposed to be the, you know, when you elevate, you take a step up from the word terror, you take it to another level. And you use terrific.
Like it'd be terrifying.
But then they just went with terrified, and then terrific was just hanging loose here as a word.
Yeah, like, you know what? Let's use it for something awesome.
Yeah, so the English language, I have to point out, is unfortunately not the best ally, specifically for us from the Global South, because I have to identify I'm from a developing country. So, terror, according to the Merriam-Webster dictionary, a state of intense, overwhelming fear. Firstly,
state of intense overwhelming
let's ask the Americans if that's what they experience from Cuba. Second, violence or threat of violence used as a weapon of intimidation or coercion. I didn't hear Cuba threatening anyone in the international realms. Well, today, okay, recently, the Cuban president has had to sort of like also start a war of words, a war of narrative with Washington. And then terror... A very frightening or terrifying aspect. And the other one, someone or something that inspires fear. Now, out of all of these things, would you say that the Americans, Helmut, I know it's sounding like I'm interviewing you, but would you, because I don't see it. I don't see the Americans being afraid of Cuba.
That's like me telling you that I'm terrified by this 15-year-old kid.
Yeah.
Or this 3-year-old kid.
But you beat up the kid anyway.
I keep beating up the kid. But then when you come to try and assess what's going on, I keep telling you, I'm being threatened by this 3-year-old.
Yeah.
Well,
it's not that we condone violence against kids, guys. Please understand that us, Eagle FM.
If you have to be told that, you need to be in Ward 16.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, nice one, Helmut. Nice one. Yeah, it's a good comeback. All right. Yeah.
Now, look, the thing is...
Even though you guys might have to go find out where Ward 16 is. It's probably in State Hospital.
Yeah. Look, the thing here is if you look at every government overthrow.
Yeah.
It's this is not just a war or basically any war. It's not just a war that starts with bombs exploding.
Yeah.
Misinformation is central to it. It starts with misinformation to the core.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, in every population, and that's actually the sad thing about the state of democracy globally.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, wherever intelligence communities take misinformation, there's always a number of people who will fall for it.
Yeah.
And those people are more often the loudest, and they will garner the largest number. And at the end of the day, they will see their government overthrow. And they celebrate shortly. We saw that with Iraq in 2003, when tomahawks were raining on in Baghdad, a lot of Iraqis were celebrating the very same thing that we saw with Venezuela after, on the 3rd of
but
January.
But were these Iraqis outside of Iraq, like with the Venezuelans outside of Venezuela?
Yeah, a bunch of them were out. So, were out. Whether it's one of those Naira testimony type of misinformation,
yeah,
it's very interesting. But the thing is, every time a government is overthrown, you find people that celebrate shortly. But in a long run, they realize that things may have been bad back then, but now it has just gotten worse.
It's a good thing you went there, because I want to interject with the next example, what was highlighted in that Al Jazeera thing that I mentioned, that which I could not find earlier today, but I watched it last week, was they realized, they looked at who was backing Marco Rubio. Now, apparently Marco Rubio has Cuban heritage.
Yeah, he does.
His grandfather or his parents were Cubans that moved there. Secondly, in his political campaign, his presidential campaigning, his backers, his financial backers, the financial backer that pays, that donates money to your political campaign, are two brothers of Cuban descent. Two brothers who lost farming assets, agricultural assets, with the Cuban Revolution that Castro and Guevara instituted back in the 60s.
Yeah.
They lost farming assets, agricultural assets. These two guys are sugar plantation industrialists in America. They are billionaires, these two brothers. There's another agricultural industrialist also in the US who also funded Marco Rubio's particular political campaign. He's also a billionaire.
Of course.
Now, in the broader scheme of things, obviously for you, dear listeners, in the broader scheme of things, you always have to look forward, like Helmut and I said, who is behind the language, the face? Why are we talking about Cuba? Now, I love what the African Union highlighted specifically with their findings. I just need to find the document now again. Okay, here we go. Was that they referenced, remember the Helms-Burton document, but here's the thing that they started off with. The Assembly expressed a serious concern about the continuous and illegal economic, commercial, and financial blockade imposed on the Cuba government and its people, because it had obviously been exacerbated with what Trump added, the additional sanctions. Secondly, and this is where things get troubling, so AU is technically taking a position already. The AU reaffirms its full support to the resolution of the UN General Assembly's necessity to end the economic, commercial, and financial blockade imposed by the US against Cuba. Now, this is also obviously not the first time that the AU has come out in one voice, dear listeners, against things that, for example, comes from a UN Security Council country. However, the AU also didn't come out in one voice when, specifically when Russia started its particular special military exercise.
The technical language is fascinating.
Fascinating, but you're walking across the border, and you're calling this an excursion. But yeah, okay, wonderful. So the AU didn't come out in full force as one voice against Ukraine. And many analysts highlight this particular talking point as something that, okay, so Russia did something specifically because no one is doing anything to the US that the US did to Afghanistan, that the US did to Iraq, that the US is now trying to do to Iran, that the US has been doing since the 1960s against Cuba, that the US did against Vietnam. These are all, remember, unapproved illegal wars again in international law that the US committed. And obviously there's the US proxy, which is Israel, which has also conducted its particular illegal wars, which meaning illegal under the definitions given by the UN, specifically about what is a legal war and so forth. And they've realized that they can roughshod international relations. Now, a country like Namibia always preaches, let's follow international relations. But the downside has been, like you explained a little bit earlier, Helmut, that there are countries who try to champion international relations, and there are countries that just don't care whether it exists or not.
No, they don't.
They really don't care. Because if their political leaders decide to make a move, which is basically war against your country, it is bad for your country.
Back in 2015, 2016, or they were to 2018 there. But the whole ICC, investigations or ideas to investigate American service members' war crimes in the Middle East, especially Iraq and Afghanistan.
Mm.
The chief prosecutor or one of the top prosecutors in ICC at the time was a Gambian lawyer, Bensouda.
No, she's still more sanctioned.
Yeah.
They are all still sanctioned, but they can't use their bank account.
Including Karim Khan, yeah. Now,
who's a British national. The other guy is the Italian national. He can't use his own bank accounts in his own country, which I think is German. No, I said Italian. They can't because their governments don't want to stand up against the Americans.
Yeah. Now, that's those are the very same people, by the way, that are telling you that, you have gender equality issues in your country, therefore you are the bad guy. Look, I
just
have
like
gender
that.
Equality issues in my country.
Just
I'm
like
working
that.
On, I'm working on it peacefully.
Just like that.
You lecturing me are literally bombing children. Believe me, I should be lecturing you on human rights, not the other way around.
Yeah.
But you know why they can do that?
Yeah.
It's because they're funding 90% of the projects in your country.
Exactly. Now, who's the one that has to look bad? Like,
So you have
an Oliver Twist situation now trying to stand up against the big guy, the big bully. And we all know that Oliver Twist didn't stand up to anyone, basically, if you've read Charles Dickens.
Nope.
Oliver Twist was an orphan. But yeah, you were saying, Helmut?
Just forget all the bombs that's been dropped. A group of three professors in last year wrote an article that came out of Al Jazeera that the US and EU sanctions have killed 38 million people since 1970. Those are just sanctions, but you have to understand that most of the countries that are sanctioned have been bombed before.
Mm.
Now, it's either they were sanctioned and then bombed and then even sanctioned even more.
Mm.
Now, with all those, the 38 million, those are just from sanctions. Combine those from all the bombs that's been dropped since 1970.
Mm.
And you have a ridiculous amount of people that has been killed so that a bunch of private interest companies can continue exploiting the resources that they want from whatever part of the region on this planet.
Yeah.
And this is where it becomes very difficult to have the conversation of, international law. Because if you are looking, if sanctions have killed 38 million from 1970. Yeah, if you push it to just shortly after World War II, then you can't help but agree with Noam Chomsky when he said, if the Nuremberg trials were equally applied, every U.S. president would be hanged. You'd have to hang every single one of them.
Mm.
And he had an interview where he was basically explaining why he said that. And this is Noam Chomsky, and this is a linguistic scholar. He's a pretty smart guy.
Mm.
Just sitting there, he was explaining like in every president all throughout his administration and the reasons why, in terms of international law, why he would be found guilty under the Nuremberg trials, as an example.
Yeah.
Why? Well, just look at Trump, for example. And let's go to war with Iran. Their first act was to bomb a school.
Yep.
Now, that's not just against the UN Charter. That's against the Geneva Convention and pretty much every convention that applies to international law that you can think of.
And then they still try to debate it?
You know what? Those guys, one of the dumbest excuses they gave with regards to that school was that that missile came from Iran. A Tomahawk came from Iran.
That's some of the things that the CNN and the other news outlets were saying. So you were selling American weapons to Iran?
So in other words, you sold your missiles to the very same people you want to disarm. That's what you're saying.
Yeah.
That's when they changed the whole thing to, you know what, we'll have to stop them from enriching. Okay.
But then everyone was still going, but you said it was a Tomahawk missile from Iran. So did you sell weapons to Iran? And they were like, no, we didn't sell anything. But I thought you were sanctioning these guys.
Yep.
Now, it's also the discussion, Amut, around narrative that I've also been seeing going on, specifically like the narrative. I tried in the first term of Donald Trump, I really tried to ignore the public relations realm. Around his presidency.
Oh, you started following it? Oh, no, I started following it way before it became...
No, but I tried to ignore it. But I'm now so entrenched in how propaganda works, because we are seeing propaganda. And this is what people have been highlighting specifically of what has happened. If you try to compare what's happening in the Ukraine conflict, how propaganda is out of control and it's basically the Russian army propaganda machine versus the NATO propaganda machine. And no one can trust any news outlet. I'll tell you today, dear listeners, no one can trust any news outlet who tries to bring a report to any media audience out there. Because it's either you will read in the language or you will see in the reporting and you'll hear in the reporting. It's either that it's pro-NATO, meaning apparently Putin is this bad guy, but people don't personally know Putin. Or, no, literally, I always say that, Howard, because when you think to yourself, for example, like what the EU guys and the NATO guys are saying, but the religious leader of Iran is a very bad guy. I'm like, I sit there thinking to myself, do you know the man personally that you can say that it's a very bad guy? Now, if you ask bare bones basic questions like that, political leaders don't have answers for these particular things that they announce just like that. It's like they blurt out these statements and then you ask, do you know the man person? No, I don't. Then how can you say that the person is a bad person?
And, you know, the painful thing is when you watch, news interviews on this from Al Jazeera, CNN, or whatever it is that you're watching it from.
Yeah.
You have this person that they are interviewing.
I don't watch CNN
according
anymore.
To the introduction.
I have to be honest, I don't watch CNN anymore.
Me neither. Believe me.
Yeah.
Because it becomes very annoying at some point, because the person that they are interviewing is supposedly an expert.
No, when I found out, like with the Iraq war and the Afghanistan invasion back in the 2000s, when I found out here in the 2010s, that much of the generals that they had as military analysts on their talk sessions, those people were paid for by CNN. Those people told CNN, for my knowledge, for my expertise, you're going to pay me. Now, in the realm of research methodology, Hamut, your research is compromised. The moment you pay someone, you incentivize them for them to participate in your research or for them to participate in your experiment. Your research is compromised. But CNN didn't see an issue with this. Even Sky News from the UK, they didn't see an issue with this. They also paid for the analysts. And when they were challenged, so you guys were paying analysts who basically told you that the Iraq war would end in 5 days, but you guys were stuck there for 15 years. What do you have to say to that? Sorry, Hamut, you were still saying.
You know, there are two points where I sort of like started questioning everything, especially things that's coming out of Western media. Because when you look at and this is not just Western media, especially it's just mainstream media in general.
Yeah.
The first thing you have to look at is who owns the company.
Yeah.
Yeah. And the more you look at that, the more you realize that what are the political point of view of this group or this organization or this company or this individual that has majority shares in this country.
Yeah.
Now the interest in terms of policy and economics of of the shareholders, that's what you are going to be hearing, being given a lot of airtime in positive light from that, from that particular or those particular media houses. And take for example one of the major discussions coming out of take for example the war between Israel's bombardment of Gaza. That's not a war.
Mm.
Yeah. War entails you have the equal amount of firepower to fire back, and they just didn't have that. Now,
which doesn't exist in reality.
No, it doesn't. Yeah. See, that's why I tell people that there's a difference between fighting and beating. Me and someone of my, and someone of my mate in terms of age and strength, that's fighting. Me and a 10-year-old, that's not a fight. That's a beating.
No, but that would be abuse, huh?
Huh?
Would be abuse.
That would be beating and abuse. And when George Congo shows up, and rightfully so,
he's not
more
not
like
his...
the successor.
Yeah,
shows up.
You realize
with,
that?
Yeah, with handcuffs, and just throw you in jail, where what you did to that kid will be done to you, and extra. In behind,
which is also a human rights violation. Yeah.
They'll just be congratulating you. That's why I'm a law-abiding citizen. That's my biggest fear.
Hey man, it's the same for me as well. When I realize drinking and driving, no, just randomly spouting nonsense on social media platforms, because people obviously would know a lawyer here and there, and make sure you've got your facts. Make sure you got your facts.
Nine bars.
Yeah.
In 1948, there's one Swedish diplomat, by the name of Bernadotte. This is someone who literally negotiated with Nazi Germany to release people that were in concentration camps.
Yeah.
And released thousands of them. And a lot of those people, most of them, are descendants of people that are in Israel today. Now, he was considered to be so good at diplomacy in terms of negotiation.
Wasn't he the guy that was a businessman? That diplomat? Yeah, he was a business person. But he acted like a diplomat / secret agent.
I'm not sure.
A tall guy, ne?
Yeah, really tall.
Yeah, it's that guy. Because they realized he was a business person / a diplomat, but they didn't know that he actually had an intelligence role to play.
Yeah, I'm not sure about if he had the intelligence role. The thing is, he's also one of the, he basically influenced the international law in a sense that made the international law to start considering, because in the beginning, international law only cared about the relationship between states.
Yeah.
But organizations and the individuals, or agencies of these international organizations, they were not considered, as such.
Mm.
Yeah.
As being active participants. Yeah.
To be protected and being maybe shielded to all kinds of negative things by the reach of international law.
Yeah.
Now, the thing is, in 1914, after the Israelis assassinated Count Bernadotte, the very same guy that negotiated their people out of Nazi concentration camps was now hired to go and negotiate peace agreement between Palestine and Israel.
It is him, Helmut.
And look.
It is him. I remember now.
That's one heck of a way of saying thank you.
Yeah.
Now,
after you helped the same people.
If what you really want is peace, you shouldn't be shooting down people that are here to broker peace. Especially someone with negotiating abilities and negotiating track record, like Count Bernadotte.
Yeah.
But they didn't consider that. They just gunned him down, and they had a very tense relationship with the Swedish, with the Swedish, royal family. And Now, that was in 1948. So, because, you know, now, after that, it would be very difficult for you to convince me that if it wasn't for October 7th, all this would not have happened. Because
it's impossible, Helmut.
You killed a negotiator in 1948. You can't tell me about October 7th as the biggest problem today.
Oh, and with Mahmoud Mamdani saying that no one trusts where he could actually point out how the Israelis were based, the Israelis and the British, because the British were always front runners and everything, how they were all basically undermining the post-colonial platform here in Eastern Africa. The British were everywhere. The British were busy undermining everyone.
You see, that's the thing about having a strong enough military power. You can just undermine everyone.
Yeah. The downside has been when we look at this particular discussion that's obviously happening with the threats towards Cuba being amplified, there is one particular observation that I have to throw in here. The only thing currently keeping Cuba safe is Iran.
That's also the thing turns out keeping Turkey safe.
Iran.
Yep.
Because Iran is keeping the US and Israel in that conflict. But if you're going to ask a question in terms of, like, if you think strategically, like strategic military thinking, is Cuba busy ramping up and its defenses and everything for a possible invasion for the Americans? Because the Americans use a terminology in this fact sheet that apparently Cuba is running a terrorist state. Here's the sentence. Cuba provides a permissive environment for hostile foreign intelligence, military, and terrorist operations less than 100 miles from the American homeland. Because that distance, the closest distance between
Florida
and Cuba, is like, I think, within the 100 mile. No? If you put it in kilometers, 100 miles is probably like 200 kilometers in distance. So that's literally the distance. So it's literally from here to somewhere between Okanja and Ochivarongo. If you pull 200 kilometers in a straight line on our highway.
Yeah.
So that's the distance, dear listeners. So just so that you know, you're not in Ochivarongo yet, but it's literally
somewhere in between.
That's the distance. Well, you just have to measure the 200 Ks. Now, immediately with that sentence, Helmut, now you have to ask yourself, who are these foreign hostile intelligence entities? Because nowhere in this fact sheet, and this is what I love about what the Americans sometimes do, they dress obscure language up as fact. There is no factual basis for this document that I'm reading, because nothing is factual in this document.
It doesn't have to be. You just need an excuse that's good enough.
For you just need words on paper to back up what you're going to start with. That's all they're doing. They just have words on paper to back up what they're starting with. Now, the other particular concern is that they're now trying to pin, obviously, like the drug trade also onto Cuba. Apparently that Cuba is a sponsoring country of the drug trade. That was the accusation towards Venezuela.
Uh-huh.
Now, everyone would ask, I thought Venezuela was supposedly the one sponsoring this drug trade discussion. But our report of last week, Helmut, about the Global Terror Index, highlighted that it seems from the South American perspective, it's Colombia that is the hub of the drug trade and not Venezuela. Because nowhere did it actually mention Venezuela in the top 10 countries even.
No, it didn't.
The top 10 countries is dominated by African countries.
No, the UN told them that before they went into Venezuela. You know what Marco Rubio said? The UN doesn't know what it's talking about. But when they were caught up in that gem with Iran, he started saying, you know what, the UN is being challenged here to show its authority. Hang on a second. You said, they didn't know what they were talking about when they were reprimanding you on Cuba. But now that you are in a gem, they must show their authority on your side. Look, the whole thing, like the example I would use is, it's like kindergarten level mistake.
Mm.
And then I realized that it was offensive to kindergartners because even they are smarter than that.
Definitely.
Yeah. So the thing is, wherever you look, that's why I keep saying, don't listen to politicians. Find out who funded his campaign.
Yeah. And then you find out why are we going.
Yeah. of those individuals, because it's mostly, you know, just one giant group. And when you look at countries like the US, that's why I don't blame citizens for the most part
for not knowing.
Not just for not knowing. I just realized with apartheid South Africa, and then I applied that same template on Israel and the US, and pretty much the same for the British. But the main template is coming from 1440s, 1450s Portugal. A country that's authoritarian, or more like just a warmongering country, the people they lie to the most are their own citizens.
Yeah.
And
now what do you call that, Helmut?
A propaganda 101.
Definitely.
The most propagandized people are people that that are in a country of a warmongering country. Take the US, for example.
Mm.
Their citizens were only, some of them to this day can't point Iran on the map.
They don't know that Africa is a continent.
A lot of them, especially much of the Western world, kept thinking Africa was a country.
Yeah.
That speaks one language.
Supposedly.
Yeah. Now, the thing is, now for citizens, that's why when it comes to, you know, that's why when it comes to, you know, it's either, you know, the US, Britain, or, you know, or, you know, France, or even throw Israel in that bucket. Believe me, the leaders in this country cook out more propaganda for their own people than they do for the outside world.
Yeah. But before we continue, Helmut, we've got an ad break quickly creeping up on us. On that note, dear listeners, we'll be back right after this with a home run.
You know, there's something about opening a Tafel Lager that brings people together.
Yeah, and once people come together, the voices follow.
Ideas get shared, laughs get louder.
New perspectives come up where you least expect them.
Because when people use their voice, conversations start.
And those conversations, they can refresh a moment and even shape what happens next.
So, grab a Tafel Lager and start the conversation. Tafel Lager, now we're talking. Not for persons under the age of 18. Enjoy responsibly.
You are now listening to The Home Run with Helmut and Dwight, weekdays from 4:30 to 6, only on Eagle FM. Download the app or tune in to a frequency near you.
Welcome back, and thank you for keeping listening. Pardon my English. We have 30 minutes to the hour of 6, so you're still listening to Home Run with Helmut and Dwight on Eagle FM. So, like I pointed out earlier before the break, that citizens of warmongering countries are, as you know, they are lied to the core by their own government. They are lied to. If you just look at, especially if you look at social media, you will find out just how many Americans that are creating content. And, you know, on things that they have just realized that their government have been engaged in, since Second World War, that, for a very long time, a lot of people that's been, you know, that's been ostracized for criticizing the government or the military for running around the world bombing countries that, you know, under false pretense. Turns out those people have been right the whole time. So when it comes to, you know, I know it's the most difficult thing you can do, but try as much as you can to separate an administration, a government, from its people. And that goes for all governments. If you know a government that's classified as under terrible leadership, believe me, if you were to sit down with the people, you would find out that they have been lied to for decades. And that's an open secret. Now, that's why, again, back to Noam Chomsky, said that propaganda is to democracy what violence is to dictatorship. Translation, in a dictatorship, information is censored because if you say something wrong, you disappear. But in a democracy, You are fed what to believe in, and it's covered in chocolate and honey and everything in a way that you swallow it without even realizing that by decades, by the time you realize, oh, hang on a second, I've been lied to. Well, you've been in a slumber for years. And unfortunately, there have been a lot of power consolidation, not only militarily and economically, but also information-wise in a lot of developing countries where it's kind of difficult. Have you just realized that when you are listing down the list, whenever the statistics of the most corrupt countries comes out, Africa is dominating the chart. This country is very corrupt. Now, let's just find out who is maintaining that corrupt regime. And you find that there's a lot of private or foreign intelligence and foreign military in the background. So this corruption here then is a symptom of the disease that is coming out of developed countries. Every time a corrupt leader on this country, on this continent has been ousted from power, they don't stay in Africa. They ran, Mobutu went to, is it Morocco or Tunisia? One of the two. I think he died in Morocco. But most of them, when they get overthrown, they run to a country that was backing them up for the most part, that basically maintained them or kept them in power. So, bring all this whole, this whole discussion to Cuba. Cuba is not perfect, but I don't think they are the problem when it comes to international law. No, they're not. They are definitely not. And if you want to understand one thing about, why can't these leaders just stand up, and fight their own presidents, fight their own governments? The thing is, in a power structure that is so connected, standing up literally gets you killed. Unfortunately, but if you just listen or more like follow sources that are not coming out of, for the most part, mainstream media, you realize that a lot of people in Israel, a lot of people in the UK, France, a lot of people in the US, just to throw a lot of people in Russia or Ukraine, a lot of people all around the world have questioned their leaders. They do that all the time. You just never hear from them because if you question the Trump administration, for example, who's going to give you airtime? Take, for example, now, if we had, an authoritarian president here in Namibia, who has basically control, or more like it's either he or her as the president, or the campaign contributors of the president for basically that helped the president ascend to power. If they have control of the media and you criticize that leadership, who is going to give you a radio station, a newspaper, or TV station to criticize them? Short answer, no one. And before you start saying, this is just, white people or brown people or black people, ask yourself one question. If you were the authoritarian president, would you allow someone to criticize you? This is part of what I talked about yesterday. Jomo Kenyatta jailed the very same guy that told the colonial occupation guys that there is no independence without Kenyatta. He was released out. In other words, if you don't release Kenyatta, you guys should forget about independence. That's what, Odinga Senior told the British. Kenyatta gets released and then he becomes president. He takes this guy and makes him vice president. That didn't end well now, did it? He was critical of the, of Jomo Kenyatta's point of view on, on economic development for Kenya, because, what he saw was that, white elites in terms of, bourgeoisie lifestyle were slowly being replaced by black elites. And the only difference between the two was skin color. That's the only difference. But greed and doing, hell bent on doing anything they can to protect their flamboyant lifestyle, they were not the same. I mean, they were not any different. They were just replacing power and money hungry white people And they were just being replaced with a power and money hungry black group. And they were not any different. And when, when is it, Jara something, Odinga started criticizing that, more like a power set up, which is not very different from the colonial one in terms of money power and, money power hungry. He was thrown in jail by the very same guy that he spent the entire colonial liberation struggle fighting for. Isn't that fascinating? Fascinating. So in the world of power, criticizing literally, when you stand in between someone who is power hungry and their goal, which is power and money, your relationship doesn't matter. And we saw that with Thomas Sankara and Blaise Compaoré. And we saw the same thing with Mobutu Sese Seko and Patrice Lumumba. And this is not something new. Chris Hani is one excellent example. Here at home, who is this guy? Anton Lubosky. Last time I checked, Anton Lubosky was white. And he dared to side with the, with non-whites. Now, how'd that go? And that's one interesting topic in Namibia. And it's a lot of people, that's the topic that makes people go, oh my God. But anyway, it goes beyond that. If you think apartheid South Africa cared more about white people than they did about black people, you are 50% right and you'll be 50% wrong. Let me explain. Yes, apartheid South Africa laid down a framework that made it look like they cared more about white people than black people. What they cared about, yes, they did to some degree, but what they cared about was, if they had to choose, they were given those options. Whenever they were given an option to choose between listening to a white person or listening to power, they chose power. If you look at just how many people who are white were assassinated with letter bombs being sent secretly by the apartheid regime to white people in Angola, Botswana, and Mozambique. You will understand that when it comes to power, if the power is white, even if you are white, if you get in between that power and the individual pursuing that power, you are a dead man. And in all these things, lying is a significant part of you. Yeah, you're going to have to lie. You are going to have to lie. Now, the misinformation happening in especially, that's misinformation, and everyone is worried about content creators on social media spreading misinformation. If there's anything that social media has exposed is that the biggest misinformation campaign the biggest misinformation distributors are mainstream media. They literally lie on a large scale to the point where they justify human rights violations and worse, war, which is basically the largest, the biggest, culprit of human rights violation. Now, when it comes to misinformation, especially when it comes to labeling a leader as a bad guy to their people so that the people themselves can protest or more like riot or even go to war in terms of civil war to overthrow that leader. Unfortunately, that method has always worked to the point where it is scary. Believe me, if any country that wanted to overthrow our current president decided to start feeding us misinformation about the president, you'd be surprised as to how many people would fall for it. You'd be surprised. Now, why does that always work? It's because every country has its own touchy subjects. That's one. And number two, every country has grievances. Every country. Now, all you just have to do is find a country find out what the main grievances of that countries are. Pay an organization, pay an organization to emphasize those grievances on radio stations and TV stations and newspapers over and over again, and you see as to how many people are going to fall for that crap. It happens all the time. That's why for me, the scariest thing a person can say is, I'm not into politics. That means you can easily be fooled.
Do you know how easy you and I, Helmut, got into politics after we said we would just look at economics, policy, developments from policy documents, and then we immediately fell into the politics.
Even
though we went more factual, we stayed more factual, more grounded in our analysis, which we are, or have been.
I know, right? If you look at, who is this? There's Ambassador Moynihan.
Mm.
Yeah. Ambassador Moynihan was was the U.S. ambassador to the UN in the 70s. Now, in 73 somewhere there, if I'm not mistaken, during the invasion of East Timor.
Oh yeah, I read of that thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You wanna know who was playing distraction so that the UN, the United Nations General Assembly, and the UN Security Council don't reach a solution that will prevent a genocide from taking place? Ambassador Moynihan was playing that role efficiently, to the point where he even started boasting about it after the war. That, it was very easy actually to distract the UN from reaching a decision that would have prevented a literal genocide in East Timor.
No, but didn't it already happen?
That invasion of 1973, I believe, that war should have been prevented. Those people did not have to die.
Yeah.
But the U.S. wanted to go ahead with that invasion.
Mm.
But now the painful thing is the U.N. would have prevented it, but they had a very awesome actor who was playing a role which... I believe that's what Linda Thomas Greenfield was playing last year during the Biden administration. Mm. That whole, voting or, either voting or like cook up excuses type of distraction.
Mm.
Yeah. And that's unfortunately is not the first time.
Yeah.
And that is not just the U.S. What the U.S. is doing, the British have done, the Spanish have done. The French have done.
Yeah.
The Portuguese have done.
Yeah.
Every country that has been a superpower have done the exact same thing of controlling, first of all, narrative and going to war whenever it felt like, and basically breaking the rules that it wanted other countries to obey.
Oh, colonialism is going to hit England hard.
Yeah.
I mean, specifically the discussion about the things that the governments... committed. For example, like very few British know about the Suez Canal crisis. Very few also know about the influence that their government played in the Mossadegh, the Iran discussion.
Yeah.
Then when it comes to Africa, it gets even more murkier. Ooh. And even more uglier.
You know, my favorite British operation throughout the entire history, history of British colonialism, which is about 200 years, was Operation Legacy. This was done in 1950s, where they were now, they just realized that the resistance on the African continent cannot be contained anymore.
Mm.
Now they decided to institute Operation Legacy, where they decided, this went on for, I think, about a period of 8 to 10 years, where they were now, Operation Legacy was dedicated to destroying as much evidence that would point to the atrocities as much as possible.
Yeah.
Yeah. And they were almost successful.
Which includes the Mau Mau.
That includes that, and actually much, 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 much worse. I mean, the soldiers themselves, or the soldiers and the commanders that were doing the destroying were basically writing to London and telling them, this is a lot of information to destroy. We don't have time.
Yeah.
Yeah. And one thing that quickly came out was especially one of my favorite, when I came across that, the first time I did that was in 2020. Yeah, no, it was in 2024. I did it as a comedy set.
Mm.
Where I said, look, I don't think I want to go on a heist with a British guy. Because you guys, well, because you know that it was just one large crowd of white people. I'm like, hey, I'm gonna have a good time here. I'm like, yeah, you know what? I'm not going on a heist with a British guy, because after you guys destroyed all the evidence about colonialism, you left out one piece of evidence. Mm. You stayed. You're just there in the corner, like you think they're gonna know. Mm. Of course we're gonna know. Mm. Yeah. Now, but the thing is, 200 years, it makes sense. 200 years of colonialism can be destroyed in 10 years. They didn't have enough time.
Which is impossible as well.
It is impossible. But the thing is, Gomes de Zurara, I think under the leadership of King Alfonso V, of Portugal, Henry the Navigator. Now, Gomes de Zurara is one fascinating guy, because if you look up the history of racism, or, you know, skin different based racism, his name pops up all the time. And the thing was
he the propagandist?
He was like the Joseph Goebbels of 1450s Portugal.
Yeah.
Yeah. He was the propaganda machine who literally wrote a book.
Well, the Spanish had their own. A couple of them.
Oh, every superpower has one.
It was the Reconquista with the Moors, the Muslim Spaniards.
Yeah.
They were Moors, but the Moors came here through North Africa, through Libya, Algeria, Guterres.
Yeah.
And then they occupied southern Spain. Northern Spain was occupied by these, you know, other European groups, I'll put it like that, because they had different language groups.
Yeah.
And then they had something known as the Reconquista. And I was like, what? Why does it sound like you are reconquering something?
Uh-huh.
Did you conquer it even to start off with in the first
place? Re means you have done it before.
Or you are trying to do something else, you know, under that label. And then when you go look it up, much of these Spanish cities today that are on the Mediterranean coast, Zaragoza, Sevilla, Valencia, what was the other ones? Is it Oviedo? And yeah, but all of those cities were Moorish cities. They were much. If you go look at like the designs and stuff that you will find still there today, those ancient buildings and stuff.
Yeah.
The history that they have
dates back to
Islamic history and Islamic history. And then obviously the other propaganda machine they had was the Spanish Inquisition about if your wife just knows a little bit too much or your daughter sounds a little bit too cheeky, yeah, she's a witch.
Yeah. If a woman can read.
No. That's impossible. She's a witch.
Yeah. Now, imagine how many witches would have right
if
now.
If she was good with her business in terms of running a pottery business in the town,
definitely
she's
witch.
A witch.
Now, if you were to wake some of those guys up right now and they will find one driving a car, they'll be like, ah, this is some Lord of the Ring type
crap. Or she's an engineer. She's definitely a witch. Sorry for women. I'm really sorry, guys. It's usually our gender. I'm sorry. We have some idiots in our gender.
Oh yeah.
History is full of those idiots. I'm really sorry, guys.
No, I think it was more paranoia than paranoia than stupidity. Competition is not something that they want to face. That they wanted to face.
Basically.
They didn't want to because they realized that. The whole goal, which is why I like to point out that power is always going to be the priority.
Mm.
Yeah. The whole skin color differences, or more like religious difference, and all those are just secondary. The main goal is power. Mm. So it's not that women weren't able to do math in the 1940s or 1920s. They have always been smart. They were just not offered the same opportunity.
Mm.
It's not that
blending incentivized, for example, like having jobs.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It's not that black people were not smart enough to do all the line of work that we find ourselves right now.
Yeah.
It's just that they were not given an opportunity. So when you disenfranchise a community, you can call them whatever you have, but just remove all the disenfranchising barriers, and then open up everything for competition. Take, for example, it's one of the dumbest thing about what's this open market economy. It's open market when you don't have a competitor. When China shows up, it's national security.
Yeah.
I thought you said open market.
Or you give all your contracts to your to the big companies in your economy,
mm-hmm.
and then supposedly it's a free economy.
Yeah, it's a free economy.
But there's only five companies dominating your economy.
Yeah.
Now, everyone would say, but that's the definition of monopoly.
Exactly.
If they monopolize all economic activity, they even monopolize the job labor market, the labor market. What are you talking about?
What do you mean open market economy?
Where's the free economy discussion?
Yeah, maybe the question you should ask when you say open market, open to who? You should be specific. Because from the in theory, it sounds like it's open to everyone.
Yeah.
But practically, it seems to entail that open only to someone who is in favor with your interest.
Or open only if you can jump that high.
Yeah.
Or you can fly that high. It's amazing. It's most one of the questions I would, as to why we have got very little intro rate, the rate of introduction into the economy of small businesses.
Mm-hmm.
Why that? It's one of those particular explanations given that there is this massive monopolization of the economy by established large companies, but the governments don't do anything. Now, the governments don't see the obvious answer that these guys are too big. Anyone else who's now young and is told by a president, go and start your business because you've got a degree now.
Uh-huh.
Now you try to start a business, but the loans that are given to you are given on the same basis as if you are the one of the big competitors.
And you're like, how am I supposed to compete with them?
How can I pay back the loan if the loan is on the level of a big of an established company's requirements?
And by the way, you can take a loan to buy a car. And you know, ever since you pointed that out, it's been a nightmare. It's easy to buy a car than buy a loan. Than buy a house.
Of course. Have you never realized this? Oh, sorry.
I never actually realized that until you pointed it out.
Yeah. It's $1 million house is more difficult to buy for a Namibian here today than $1 million car. Same value in terms of price tag, brand spanking new. The one is made somewhere else, the one is made here, but same value. But the financing tool or instrument given to by the commercial banks is a lot more horrendous for the one product.
That's a house.
And is easy to come by for the other product. So you can literally be a tenderpreneur. From where were you? Tsumkwe. You can literally be a tenderpreneur from Tsumkwe, and all you've got to do is the tender value is probably just 100,000 worth, and in between it's a 1 year project that you're probably doing. But you can literally from that money go and apply for a vehicle loan for $1 million car. Now I ask you this, Helmut. Both products, ne? Under my definitions that I was learned with regards to what is a consumer durable product.
Yeah.
Consumer durable product is a product that lasts long, but you buy it.
Which I'd assume is a house in this case.
Which is the house and the car. They are of equal value.
Yeah.
But the one stands still. The other moves around as moving parts and also has intervals of service and maintenance that you've got to apply. But the one depreciates in value. It becomes cheaper. The other just appreciates in value. Mm-hmm. A property, Helmut, you can never go wrong with a property.
Yeah.
Now, when I mentioned the land, when I continuously throw the land bill into discussions, and I say, when you look at the arguments that the politicians from the various parties in the National Assembly put forward for the land bill, they come and talk to you about a farm, but you're a young person in a city. Or you're a disenfranchised person living in a town, an urban setting. Where is the farm in the town? Are you not trying to inconvenience that Namibian by telling them, go live in the bush and try to be a farmer when you don't know anything about farming? Or would you rather try to meet the need where that person is, which is provide affordable housing? Affordable housing would entail, how do you actually lessen the perceived 300,000 housing backlog if it has not changed in between the 7-8 years that it was measured since 2018.
Right.
Yeah. It always brings us back to that talk. Doesn't matter if we start there with international relations, we always end up here with housing in Namibia. I'm sorry for that, guys.
I know.
I don't know why I keep doing that, but yeah. But the train of thought, things are always interconnected, Helmut.
Yeah, on Cuba, I'm going to point out one of my favorite quote, which I pointed out already again from Noam Chomsky, that when it comes to information, how do I put this? Yeah, he's the one who said propaganda is to democracy what violence is to dictatorship.
It's under the guise of democracy that propaganda thrives.
Look, one thing I totally understand about, or more like find fascinating about lying, is how it, it's ironically, it's this glue that holds society together. Yeah. I found a piece, I found a meme online that asked a very, funny question that, if all people on this planet for 24 hours lost the ability to tell lies, which line of work will collapse first? Or which industry will collapse first?
Law.
Oh, yeah.
Law and politicians.
Forget before you get to law.
But everyone knows that.
Yeah, like industry. Oh, industry-wise, oh, my God. Laws would be...
Law.
Believe me, you don't want your lawyer telling you the truth. And, you can only imagine job interviews that day.
For who?
For anyone who is...
For graduates or for those established lawyers?
For anyone who is just attending a job interview. Where do you see yourself in 10 years? Who am I, Bushiri?
Not with you.
Yeah, not with you, definitely. I'm just here to steal money and then I'm out. And everyone's like...
No, I once gave such an answer. I told the person, listen, you can't... You... Yeah, 5 seconds, we come back right after this.
Step right up to ShopRite's Big Low Price Carnival, where the deals are big and the savings are even bigger. Get show-stopping deals like 6.6-liter platinum digital air fryer for only $999.99. That's a big deal. And 200 grams Nescafe Classic Roast instant coffee for a low $135.99. Valid until 7 June 2026. Don't miss out on these unbelievable savings and more at the Big Low Price Carnival, only at ShopRite. Plus, you could stand to win one of 250 trolley dashes. Simply buy any 3 or more participating products and stand to win with ShopRite's Big Low Price Carnival. Competition ends 7 June. T's and C's apply.
Welcome back. The time is just 6 o'clock on the dot. And if you just tuned in, you have tuned in towards the end of... at the end of... at the end of a home run with Helmut and Dwight on Eagle FM. So like I pointed out, don't point much of the fingers to citizens when it comes to misinformation. Because believe me, they are just as, they are being lied to in the same way, if not worse than you. So, until tomorrow, same time, same place on your favorite radio station from me, y'all have a good evening.
And on that note, guys, stay tuned for the next program after the break, which will be the China Corner for the month of June. But stay tuned. We'll be back right after this.
Tune in to The Home Run with Helmut and Dwight on your number one talk radio station, Eagle FM, and be part of an in-depth discussion on events you didn't know you needed to hear until you do. From Namibia, Africa, and around the world, tune in from Monday to Friday from 4:30 to 6 p.m. only on Eagle FM. You are now listening to The Home Run with Helmut and Dwight, weekdays from 4:30 to 6, only on Eagle FM. Download the app or tune in to a frequency near you.